Well, welcome to episode 15 of the Wright County Restoration Project podcast. My name is Jamin.
And I'm Sam.
And we are here with the fourth president of the United States, James Madison.
Yes.
And there's a good deal to talk about as it relates to Madison. Of course, another man who is perhaps better known by the things he did prior to time in office than the things he did during office. Although, like with Thomas Jefferson, Madison makes some decisions which are quite consequential as it relates to a young nation. And so we're going to kind of work through it together. And I guess we should begin with talking about, we've talked about it, of course, as we walked through the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, but talking about Madison's contribution to the original documents and the founding of our country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see James Madison as one of the very key people that frames and organizes the creation of the Constitution. We have, as we've talked about before, right after the Revolution and during the Revolution, once the colonies declare their independence, we, as a country, are under the Articles of Confederation. It's a very loosely binding document, but it does bind these 13 colonies together. And so when you have that, and there are different committees that are based off of, a committee of safety, which was kind of whatever they could do to kind of produce military accoutrements and weapons and whatever they could get their hands on to help out the military. It wasn't a big help, but there was that. There was different groups, and there was a president, interestingly, but he was just presided over this Congress that basically they wouldn't really decide anything unless it was a unanimous vote. And so one of those weird trivia things is who, you know, there's actually, I think, six or seven presidents before Washington. Kind of an interesting thing. I'll have to look at that a little more, but one of those goofy history trivias that you can kind of play with your friends, because there were presidents of these 13 colonies before it was a United States under a constitution. And so we come to that time after the Revolution when there is a need for a constitution. These states are a really kind of, they're warring against each other in a way. Not necessarily with arms, though there was some skirmishing and things of people that were dissatisfied. It was mostly in commerce.
Yep.
And we'll see this continue on. Commerce is a really big issue. The colonies had great debts that they still owed to England. And there were some just real difficulties. And England and a lot of other places didn't really take these 13 colonies seriously. And James Madison really is one of those forward-thinking people that takes and he sees the need for a system of government. And, you know, to think about it, he didn't even know what that exactly looked like when he started this process. But he and a few others organized the Constitutional Convention, inviting delegates from each of the states. And the initial setup for this and the initial the verbiage that went out and told people they were going to revise and amend the Articles of Confederation. Very early on in their discussion, they kind of decide, at least a good number of them decide, to kind of amend it out of existence, in a sense. But that was also something that a few of the delegates decided, and I think at least one of the states decided to just up and go home when that happened. It was a very big deal, and it was seen by these states. And these states were very... They loathed giving up any of their power or autonomy as individual states. And part of what the Constitution does is it grants some power to a federal body of government, to a legislature, to a judiciary, and to the president, and that those branches of government become what we now know today as you know, our form of government. But this is something that Madison is really a key member of the men that push and organize and make this Constitution a reality.
Yeah, and to that end, James Madison was one of the co-authors of the Federalist Papers, and the Federalist Papers were written specifically to justify and to argue for a strong federal government. And it's an interesting turn in that when we see James Madison in the presidential role, he's not a Federalist.
Correct.
He is a Democratic Republican. He had branched off with Thomas Jefferson, who was a very good friend of his, out into this opposition party of the Democratic Republicans, which were, while you know, obviously there was plenty of agreement between the two parties, it was the lesser of the Federalist parties. But he was one of those that wrote the Federalist Papers. He was one of those that was advocating for a very needful, strong federal government idea, at least, a unified federal government bringing about the Constitution of the United States. And the Federalist Papers, of course, are something which a lot of people are reading today, and it's worth your time to read through them to understand the thinking of these men and why it was they were thinking what they were thinking as it related to a federal government, the powers and the restrictions and these sorts of things. It was not the only argument of the day. I know a lot of people today, they read the Federalist Papers as founding documents. I'm a little bit hesitant to call them that. They are certainly documents related to the founding. I'm a little bit hesitant in that it was one side of the argument, and it was the side that brought about the system of government we have. So it's good for understanding the thought process of the system of government, but not necessarily the fears and concerns that caused some people to push back and bring some of those amendments to bear. And many of the amendments to the Constitution were the pushback amendments to the Federalist idea as relayed in the Federalist Papers, but very influential, very influential as it relates to the Federalist Papers, very influential in the actual putting together of the Constitution of the United States.
Very much so. And Adams and Washington being on that more of that Federalist side, as we've seen and we've kind of talked through in the previous podcasts, really struggled with Madison and Jefferson, and it was a very bitter struggle between these men who had all been very close at the founding of this fledgling government, and it definitely was one of these interesting times when things begin to divide, but also there is a need for some opposition to kind of rub off some of the rough edges and give us the documents that we have today. And that's where you have people that do, even at the time of the signing of the Constitution, there are those members that are unwilling to sign because there is no Bill of Rights. And we just talked through the Bill of Rights. Why was that important? And it's interesting, even talking and hearing others discuss it, one of the things that you can look back and maybe was even something that, you know, how would they have known? But, you know, was there even a, would it have been even better if the founders had put together some sort of book of definitions on the terms that they were using? In the day and age in which we live, it's very interesting that these words and these meanings definitely get twisted. Sometimes it seems on a yearly basis to mean various things, and it's just interesting to think. But you know, you can always analyze. It's easy to be an armchair quarterback on these things, but there is so many good things that came from people that didn't just go along with how things were going, but took a stand and said no. We need to make sure that we can lay out these rights that people have that are protected by government, not given by government, protected by government, and that the people need that in the coming days to be able to hearken back to those things and say, no, we have freedom of speech.
Right.
We have freedom to assemble, those kinds of things. And that is why some of that opposition, especially during these times, was a very good thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we have Washington and we have Adams, and then Thomas Jefferson is our first opposition party president. Mm-hmm. And Madison is his Secretary of State throughout those years, and then that gives way to Madison being elected as the fourth yes. president of the United States. And he had a somewhat interesting presidency throughout the course of the various other presidents. They'd been working hard to stay mm-hmm. out of European wars, to stay Absolutely. Out of the problems surrounding Great Britain and France and a war that had been going on for some time and very resource heavy. Obviously, there'd been, we talked last time about some of the elements of Thomas Jefferson getting into some foreign affairs yes. and the nature of the United States trying to establish themselves and their own commerce, their mm-hmm. own shipping, their own exports, their own importing and such, and some of the sticky issues surrounding that. What does Madison's presidency look like?
So it's interesting, kind of delve deeper into what you were saying. The makeup of America is very interesting at this time. These 13 colonies, we have a coast, and on that coastline, there are these main shipping ports, places like Boston and New York and these areas that very much rely upon the free flow of commerce. Mm-hmm. And you have almost these two factions in a way. Then inland, you have people that are producing their own things. Right. They are weaving and spinning their own cloth. They're manufacturing their own goods, working metal, those type of things. But still at this point, there is still enough of a frontier to these countries, these states, that much of the finer things mm-hmm. Can really only be brought in from England or France or over in Europe. And so you really have a difference of opinion, or a difference of goals mm. in the various people and what you're invested in. If you think about if you were in that time, if you were a man that was involved in shipping, well, shipping would be very important to you. Right. And into this, now that we kind of laid out the way that the states, their interests lay in two different places, just depending on where you were kind of geographically. And with that, you have France and Britain fighting a very costly war. Mm. Napoleon Bonaparte comes out of the French Revolution and really begins to just march all over Europe and right. taking things over. And much to the dismay of most of the countries in Europe, and Britain was kind of the only power that was really going to step in and kind of check this unbridled kind of rule that Napoleon was going on. And this winds up being really one of the main reasons why the French and the British begin to seize American shipping vessels mm-hmm. and the materials and the crews that are on them. Both of these countries need these things, and in their justification of it, they're usually seizing materials and supplies that are going to the other country. So right. in a way, since they are funding our enemies, we should take it.
Justified as a part of the war effort.
Absolutely. And so this becomes a huge thorn in the side of these American colonies, because a lot of the very wealthy men that were making good money were making it in shipping. There was quite a bit of this commerce going on, and it came to a point where right around the beginning of the War of 1812, it's estimated that somewhere around 70 million in materials of that, in that day's monies and ships had been seized by both of these countries. And this was extremely aggravating to these, the men who were shipping, the men who owned these ships. It's a huge loss to mm-hmm. lose all this material, to lose the manpower. And it's something that really enrages many of these people, and some want to go to war with England, some want to go to war with France, some want to go to war with both, and then of course the people in the interior didn't want to go to war with either, and but everybody wanted their things from Britain and France.
Yep.
And so their Congress tries by saying, hey, we're just going to say you can't buy anything, you can't import anything from Britain. That'll stop them. Well,
put a big Made in USA stamp on everything, right?
Which, okay, understandable. Even in our day and age, that's something that, you know, we can stake our pride on and say, hey, this, you know, this set of boots was made in the USA, which is a good thing. But what this does is, because of the quality of the goods, it really just emboldens a whole smuggling ring of people smuggling things from Canada. And you have all these, a whole group of customs houses and officials, and they're trying to stop it, and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it really becomes just a way that the people in the interior are making more money, because, hey, you don't have anywhere else to go. But all these shipping companies, all these men that are involved in that, all the infrastructure that goes into building ships, supplying ships, manning ships, and the cities on the seaports. Very often when these kind of things would come in, they would talk about the grass growing in those cities, because the commerce goes away from the coasts and goes inland, because that's where the money's being made. And it's really interesting, but these are kind of the growing pains mm-hmm. of a fledgling nation. And it really comes to a head when the War of 1812 is started, mm-hmm. And Madison and Congress decide that. But Even in that, it was handled extremely poorly. Yep. And got off to a very bad start.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to, you know, we're not going to relitigate whether or not they should have gotten into the war and
yes.
these sorts of things. That's something which I would encourage the listeners mm-hmm. To always be careful about, is to try to put yourself into a, with the documents that we have and whatnot, into a person's place and into the place of where the country was, and to try to relitigate decisions is an iffy thing. Now, there's a place for it, and there's always a time where we can think through the things that we know full well, have the decisions that have been made and how they were made, and how perhaps we might have made different decisions, or those decisions may have been costly. And we will see here that the War of 1812 did not go well, was quite costly. And yet, maybe in some ways it did end up working the desired end at the end yes. of the day, just in a very messy and in very unfortunate way, and with a difficult set of circumstances. But we do see this war begin, and it's particularly against Great Britain is the mm-hmm. the foe that they aim their sights at.
Yes.
Declared war against Great Britain, and so begins about a 3-year war, 2.5-3 year war. That would not go real well, especially at the beginning.
Yes, yes. Well, it's interesting, and when you look at it, President Madison didn't really want to go to war, as far as we can tell. But this was a very difficult time, as we've said. And so what really happens is there is really a closed-door session where a bill is proposing war was discussed. And it was passed in a secret session in June 19th of 1812. President Madison fixed his signature and issued a proclamation declaring war against Great Britain. And it's interesting, the United States has only been a nation for about 25 years mm-hmm. when this happens. The Constitution is just a brand new document. And one of the issues is that Madison really, his cabinet members were fairly weak, mm-hmm. Weak men, and one of the biggest issues was, and the weird way in which all this happened was, even the information that that America was at war with England doesn't really get out in the way it needs to. Mm. Some of the first skirmishes and things that happen, the British find out in Canada before the Americans on the other side of the border find out that they're at war with them. And it is really a really kind of, you know, we would use words like fiasco and other things, just a bad situation in which, and there are many things that are really tried in the field for the first time as far as how does this system work when we have a large militia
right.
being a part of the military. There's a situation where a huge chunk of the army is the militia,
yeah.
and there's this whole plan to invade Canada, and when they get to the point right at the river there to cross over into Canada, all the militia guys say, "We aren't going, you can't make us," which is an interesting thing. And the militia, you know, basically the way they read the documents, we're here to expel invaders to protect our homes,
right.
but we're not an invading force. And it basically shut down this whole operation to invade Canada. And other situations like that happened throughout the war. And also a lot of kind of armchair generalship.
Yep.
When we see probably one of the most prominent things is when the British march and take Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what happens is the Secretary of War goes out and he's giving orders, and there's various people that go out and give orders from the government to the military and things, and it's things don't go well when you have too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yep.
And it was also one of these things that I don't think in declaring war, seeing how this all went, I don't think anybody ever foresaw the British marching on Washington and burning basically most of the government buildings to the ground.
Yeah, they burned the White House, they burned Congress, they burned the Library of Congress, they burned it all to the ground.
Yeah, and really, to the British perspective, and a lot of people thought, well, there it goes. That's the end of, you know, this idea of the United States of America. Turns out it's we the people of the United States, not we the buildings or
That's
we
right.
the even the president. And and we also, you know, if you read the history of Dolly Madison saving a lot of documents and paintings and things from the White House, which, you know, is we're grateful as a nation that those things were preserved.
James Madison's wife, by the way, her name was
yes.
Dolly. Dolly
yes.
Madison.
And she's an interesting. Interesting when you see different couples, even ones you probably know, and especially throughout history, they're definitely sometimes very much opposite of who each other is.
Yeah, and that would be the case with them, to be sure. James
mm-hmm.
Madison being quite reserved and Dolly
yes.
not being at all.
Right.
She was a widow and had a child before they got married, and she was very much the socialite and he was very much not.
Yes, and she kind of sets a precedent for the president having kind of being a bit of a, or the president's wife kind of being a mover and shaker, kind of fashion icon
mm.
of her day, which kind of interesting, but definitely unique, kind of one of the first ladies as we would kind of think of them today, kind of having a little more of a role than just being the wife of the president.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. So we have James Madison, we have the War of 1812, and out of this war, came, and you had talked about some of the unique things about it.
Mm-hmm.
The United States military was by no means ready for a war
no.
when this began. They're bringing in the militias. They actually used mercenaries. They hired mm-hmm. pirates. They used Native Americans. They did all sorts of things. I know at the Battle of New Orleans,
yes.
a good amount of their artillery was actually pirate artillery
yes.
That they used. And the Battle of New Orleans was after the Treaty of Ghent was actually already
it was,
signed,
yes.
Word had not gotten back yet, and it was a tremendous win for the United States.
Really,
of
almost the only.
Really, the only win.
Yeah, yep.
and that's where Andrew Jackson starts his rise in prominence as
mm-hmm.
a general there. We also see the Star Spangled Banner
yes.
Come out of the War of 1812.
Fort McHenry.
Yeah, and so we see that being written during a siege
mm-hmm.
With the American flag being raised at the fort and everything, and so there were some lasting things that come from the War of 1812,
mm-hmm.
and yet as a whole it's more or less a stalemate. By the time the treaty is there, Great Britain does not have the resources to throw at the United States
mm-hmm.
that they would need to particularly win the day. The United States wins that kind of that last battle, Battle
yeah.
of New Orleans, and yet simultaneously was woefully ill-prepared for
yes.
a war against Great Britain again. And of course, after the East Coast, they come down to New Orleans and they threaten the Louisiana Territory in that time, or that part of the United States that was the Louisiana Territory. And that kind of ends the War of 1812. Anything else about that war specifically that you wanted to mention?
Well, I think it is interesting, and like you mentioned, we see Andrew Jackson come onto the stage, and he becomes kind of more of a nationally known figure through this. And it's interesting to note, and we will be talking about him further on, because he is a president, and he's one of the more kind of rough homespun type presidents that we will see as we continue on. He was not the refined, learned man that we see in a Jefferson or a Madison. He was not a super, I mean, he definitely had some resources by the time he was there, and did have, he married into some wealth at that point, but definitely a unique and very much kind of in a product of these colonies. He has a very interesting history as well, and we'll talk about him a little more when that time comes. But he does take on this very unique situation where this New Orleans, which, as we said in the last podcast, is a fairly new acquisition of the United States, and you have quarters of French, you have Spanish, you have many of the native populations. It's a very interesting mix that he's handed, and most of them probably weren't necessarily as pro-United States as you would think, but he does bring order out of that chaos. Like you said, he enlists Jean Lafitte and his pirates to help. He works to really, in a very short amount of time, put up some bulwarks and stop the British from coming in. And the British were, at this point, pretty... And this is something we see throughout the Revolution and a little bit here in the War of 1812, where the British have been steamrolling their way through things so easily that they maybe don't take the precautions that they should. And Jackson, being a fighter, he'd been a general, he'd been fighting in the Cree and Seminole Wars quite a bit before this. And so he knew his stuff, he knew what he was doing. And the British paid a pretty heavy price for that mistake. And it is interesting, and a lot of people say, well, that all happened after this treaty was signed.
Right.
And it is interesting, but you know, it's hard to say what if in history. But if things had not gone so well and the British had been able to take over Louisiana, or at least New Orleans at that point, it may have been a very different thing when it came to giving that up.
Yeah.
And so while, yes, technically a treaty had been signed, the information hadn't gotten back to the colonies, of course. They probably would not have fought if they had known. But it definitely wasn't of completely no consequence.
Correct.
that particular battle was fought. And it does put Andrew Jackson in the national spotlight as a hero, as a savior of the Republic, and it really gives the nation a win.
Yes.
If you end on a win, it feels a lot better. And so they're able to end on that win, they hold it up, and as we'll see going throughout, there are quite a few generals, men like Zachary Taylor and Grant and others, as we're talking about presidents, that because of their command of men in the field and ability to win in the field, that they are put on a national stage and put up as president. Definitely kind of the heroes of the hour, and that becomes a very important thing. And so as we see through the War of 1812, it gives a chance for some of those men to rise to the top and to kind of test their mettle.
Yeah, and it also allows, as you said, they end the war ends on a high note. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it kind of redeems Madison's presidency.
It does.
Because before that, he was the war was quite unfavorable to him, and it did not look good to him. And we would probably not put Madison as one of the better presidents,
right,
certainly that we've studied so far, but even in a more broad scale, mm-hmm. we would not call Madison one of the better presidents. But as far as in the eyes of the people and in the eyes of history, and American history in some yeah. sense, the patriotic American history, the Battle of New Orleans really does kind of redeem it and give it a measure of positivity in the American consciousness, as opposed to just a total fiasco, which it pretty much was throughout most of it. It was just a fiasco.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, before we wrap up here, we need to talk a little bit about how James Madison, other than his legacy as a president, he was another slave owner, owned something yep. akin to about 100 slaves in his estate in Montpelier. But as we think through these things, there's some other elements of Madison that have become somewhat controversial today. Yes. Within our current cultural deconstructionism of the American founding. And we talked about this a little bit with Washington. We consider it a little bit with Jefferson, as it talks about his separation of church and state thing yep. letter, and how that has been deconstructed today as a handhold to beat this idea of churches and people being able to have the freedom to function in a religious way in secular systems. And we've debunked a little bit of that. So we've debunked a little bit with George Washington. We've debunked a little bit with Thomas Jefferson. And we've got to do a little bit here with James Madison as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting to note, and as we've talked about with these other founders, there has been a real trying to rewrite yeah. or read between the lines, dig up new things about these men to really try to shape a whole different understanding of who these men were and what they believed from what the country has held and what history has told since the founding. And this really starts really in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, yep. in the 1900s, really pushing things that really don't align with at least the majority of what we see written by these men.
Right.
And the things that they saw as important in the things they passed in legislation and other things. And when it comes to James Madison, one of those things that was kind of dug up in the 1940s was this a writing called the Detached Memoranda. This is kind of an interesting thing, and it really was new to me when I was doing my research to find out about Madison. But it's an interesting thing and something that I think it's good for us to understand. What is this document? It's something where it's much later in life, as far as we can tell,
yeah.
that Madison wrote this. And in it, he expresses some apprehension to the government's involvement when it comes to religion, whether the Congress should have chaplains, and as far as the government giving tax breaks to religious organizations, some things like that. And this is an interesting thing, but it's also interesting that really this was only published officially in 1946.
Yep. Yeah, and that's really important to understand. Whenever we talk through these things, and the detached memoranda do exist, right? And very yeah. similar to what we talk about as it relates to George Washington and his views, or Thomas Jefferson and his views, we never want to ignore the fact that these things exist. And the detached memoranda do state and reflect a measure of displeasure or concern over various elements of the government endorsement of various yes. elements of religion. And there are a couple of different thoughts that we always want to walk down here. The first is that these things were not found until, not even just published, but not found until the 1940s. And in recognizing that, we see that this was not something that Madison ever, even perhaps on his deathbed or whatever, desired to get out. It was not like a deathbed confession. It was not a, well, these yes. thoughts have been bouncing around in my mind and I've wanted to get them out, but public pressure and the society in which we are living in would never have let me do it. So yes. now on my deathbed, I'm releasing these things to the public. It was nothing like that. These were writings, and we see this not just with the presidents, but we see this with so many, perhaps you as well, in our social media culture. We see a situation where everybody are they're taking their private thoughts, the things that are in their minds, and they're putting them down. And they're putting them down in a way that previous to social media, it might have been in a private journal, or it might have been in a personal conversation with a friend, or it might have been in some sort of memory hole. Something where you put it down the memory hole and you've said it and you've thought it, but either you're going to look back later and say those were kind of silly thoughts, or you're going to say, well, those are, yes, private thoughts and ideas, but simultaneously, I never got to the point of fleshing out those ideas to where they became something that I am willing to take public, or that I am willing to put out there as a defining moment for me. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that this becomes that. Yes. Where, to whatever degree, James Madison, as he writes these detached memoranda, and they're a little later in life, and maybe he had been able to reflect on some things, but as he's writing these things, to whatever degree they were there, it's quite clear that this was never intended by him or anyone in his estate to be legacy defining.
Yes.
And what we understand about what's happening right now in the deconstruction of history and of patriotism and in our culture is that if people want something gone, they will find a reason.
Yes.
And what we're seeing today is we're seeing people wrap history around their narrative. Mm-hmm. And this is not new. This is not unusual. History is always written by the winners, and history always has a throughput of narrative to it. And yet we need to understand as we think through these things that when a person who is in the public eye says things, writes things, thinks things, they are also keenly aware of what they're putting out in their most public way.
Yes.
And if Madison had wanted these thoughts to whatever degree he thought them, and again, I would not necessarily disagree with him as far as I'm a pastor of a church, but as far as the government giving tax breaks to religious organizations, mm-hmm. I don't like it. I don't like where it's taken churches. I don't like where it's taken things. It's not as bad as a lot of people think it is. As far as Johnson and the Johnson Amendment, it's you know, a lot of people say, well, the church has become a wing of the state. It hasn't. 501c3 has not done that. You can disagree with me, but it has not done that to our churches. However, that being said, I agree with Madison in that particular mm-hmm. stance. That being said, also, Madison did not see fit to make these the cornerstones of his perception, of his policies as president, as Secretary of State before being president. Mm-hmm. He had a tremendous amount of sway and influence.
Yes.
And he did not bring that influence to bear. So much so that nobody would have connected Madison to these thoughts until the 1940s.
Absolutely.
And to that end, I think we need to be careful to educate ourselves. Basically, that's the long and short of it, is mm-hmm. people are hearing these sound bites and they read what Madison wrote that was found in the 1940s and they say, oh, wow, you know, maybe we have this great secular government and these guys weren't very religious and they did not approve of religious things and we need to get religion out of government, and none of them believed that. Mm-hmm. For all of their musings, we know from the way government was formed, established, and directed through these first four presidents that none of them believed that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like you said, we can see, at least from what Madison actually did
right.
and what he stood for when he was in government, that none of these thoughts that, yes, they came later in this detached memoranda really were anything or impacted anything that he did. If he did have these thoughts in the back of his head, he was definitely doing pretty much the complete opposite.
Right.
It's interesting when you look at just some of the things, just hitting some high points of his record. In 1789, Madison served on a congressional committee which authorized the approval to select paid congressional chaplains. So he was a part of that committee. President Madison in 1812 signed a federal bill which gave economic aid to a Bible society with its goals of mass distributing the Bible. So this is something that's even, you know, one might even wonder, you know, is that the government's place to
right.
give economic aid to a place giving out Bibles? But Madison as president did that. And we may struggle, you know, saying, hey, you know, if the government gave economic aid to a place that was printing another religious book, we may struggle with that. So yeah. is that the right place? Well, that's an interesting discussion. But obviously, James Madison felt that this was something that he wanted to encourage with mm-hmm. some government funds. It's also interesting that through his presidency, he produces many public and official religious expressions, proclamations of days of prayer, days of fasting, days of thanksgiving. So he doesn't shy away from any of that, yeah. as you would think someone, if his heart and soul was really a secularist at heart, why would he have gone along with all those things and done all those things in his public life?
Yeah, and it's important because you could see, okay, well, maybe they were politicking, and there's always an argument. If people want to prove a point, they will always be able to prove it.
Yes.
But these were not men that lacked resolve.
Yes.
These were not men that lacked principle.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not men that lacked the will to say what needed to be said according to their conscience. And that's important to understand. And so be careful, you know, as you hear the deconstruction of American history today, be careful with these things. Be careful both ways.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that you don't want to do is just say, well, that never happened. Because a lot of this stuff did happen. A lot of these things, they're taking history and they are interpreting it through a lens. And this lens is effectively a lens of everything American is, that America was just a colonial power meant to propagate racism throughout the world. And a colonizing power, excuse me, and an empire-building place. And it always had bad intentions. And of course, that is their lens and they are looking through that lens. We are looking through a different lens. Our lens is that these were good men, men of principle, men who desired to bring about something unique and good and right and built it upon a Judeo-Christian foundation. And here's the important part. Evidence doesn't really tell you one way or the other because evidence has to be interpreted. But what does tell you one way or another is results.
Yes.
And what we see in the results is a group of men who is that true American history, as we have learned it and known it prior to this deconstruction effort, is the American history that conforms with the results that we've mm-hmm. seen in the country. And to that end, we can have a measure of confidence that our interpretation of the facts that we see them is the interpretation that is right. And that doesn't, of course, mean we give people a pass for immoralities and injustices yes. and such, and this is going to become more important as we get closer to the 1860s.
Yes.
But this does help us remember that the nation is not a we don't have to follow the fruit of the poisonous tree idea, as the New York Times 1619 Project would lead, be attempting to lead mm-hmm. an entire, and Howard Zinn before that. Howard Zinn has been a big favorite of the communist left for some time now, and his rethinking of American history, and maybe we'll have to have a podcast about his book at some point. But they would lead you to believe something entirely different,
mm-hmm.
and that's simply based upon a fundamentally different worldview and a fundamentally different lens through which they interpret facts, a lens that does not bear up to historical scrutiny.
Absolutely.
Well, anything else on James Madison before we're finished here?
Well, I think it's an interesting president to study.
Mm-hmm.
One that a flawed man, a man that had a very huge impact on the founding of our Constitution, on the building of what we know as this United States, of our system of government, and definitely dealt a difficult hand in the time in which he is president.
Yep.
There are some really difficult times, and he has to navigate this ship of state through these times. And while one can point out quite a few errors that were made either by him or by people that he appointed to places that really weren't qualified to be in those positions, it is interesting that things do continue on.
Mm-hmm.
The ship of state continues on. It's handed off, and that I think all in all, there are some really good things that we can thank a man like James Madison in doing. But it's interesting, and it's good to look at all the different points of view, as we did with some of the things that have been brought up in recent years about what did this man really think? What was his belief system like? And it's good to not shy away, like
yep.
you said, from what's out there. But let's take it all in, but also look carefully at all of the evidence,
right.
All of the writings, all of the speeches and the acts that were done by these men, and really judge them not only by what they put out there, but also by the times and the history in which they lived. And I think it's an interesting thing to look at. And for your further study, definitely look into the War of 1812, a very interesting conflict, one that has a lot of interesting lessons in it as far as being prepared, not going into something that you don't know what's going on, and really how devastating war can be. Mm. This is kind of the last time that another nation marches upon the soil of the United States and really wreaks havoc. Kind of an interesting thing that we've been blessed not to have a lot of that happen
yeah.
in the United States. The American Civil War was really brother against brother. It was us destroying our own house in a way. But really, we have not had that invading force really destroy in our country, which has led to much prosperity.
Yeah.
But an interesting time, an interesting study, and so a part of history that not terribly well known, but something that along with the presidency of James Madison is something that is an interesting part of history.
Well, this has been the Wright County Restoration Project podcast, mm-hmm. and we're thankful to have you listening, watching. We would encourage you to like, subscribe, share, let other people know what we are doing here. If you found the information valuable, if it's inspired you to do a little extra reading, a little extra studying, a little extra thinking through some of these things, we've done our job. And that's the desire, is that we would be able to help people get back to an understanding of the founding so that we can understand. Because mm-hmm. if you understand history, then you understand where you are, how we got here, and where we need to go from here.
Absolutely.
So thank you all for tuning in, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. If you have any questions, want to add anything to the mix, want to make any contributions, WCRP, that's Wright County Restoration Project, WCRP@LegacyBaptistChurch.net. We'll get those emails, and we'll look forward to reading them, referencing them if needed in the weeks to come. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Good.